had like Chance the Rapper got on there and was like trying to vouch for like a Kanye West 2020 presidency. It was being like, he's just as good as the other guys. The other guys are shitty. And it's like, and they couldn't refute it. And I was so angry.
Yeah. I mean, that's not, yeah.
No, it's a true, it's a, I know that they're bad. They're all bad. But then they're all like bad. People who, all right, nigga, all right. Who's going to be Kanye's Department of Energy pick?
He doesn't know.
He doesn't care about that. Like, all right, well, nigga, I might care about that. Like, you know what I mean? All right, guys, we don't have a lot of time. We got to get through this now. So when we left off our hero, okay, he's not
our hero.
He's not really the hero. Mao was in the Jingang Shan Mountains, kind of repairing a force and building his force that he would kind of conduct battle with. In the spring of 1928, the Central Committee ordered Mao's troops southern to Hunan, hoping to spark peasant uprisings. Mao was skeptical, but he complied. They reached to Hunan, where they were attacked by the KMT, and they fled after heavy losses. Meanwhile, KMT troops had invaded Jingang Shan Mountains, leaving them without a base and wandering the countryside. Mao linked up with Zhu Di and Lin Bao, retook the Jingang Shan Mountains, and then were rebuffed. And then fought a guerrilla war in the mountains. The underground Central Committee ordered Mao to march to South Hunan, but this time he refused, and they got kicked out of the mountains by the KMT. And then they would take them again, and they were joined by a defecting KMT regiment in Ping Dai Wei's 5th Red Army. In the mountains there, they were unable to grow crops to feed everyone, and they starved. At this time, Mao meets meets a woman called He Zexin. He was an 18-year-old at the time, an expert guerrilla warrior, a capable fighter.
Wait, how are you an expert guerrilla warrior at age 18?
Oh, because you've been shooting people since you were 14.
Okay, all right, because you've been in it for a while, right? During your formative years, you soak it all up.
Think about it. How many times do like Green Berets really go to war? Or Navy SEALs? Like, how many years do they really spend? Like, they go to war maybe one or like for 2 years in total.
Yeah.
If you're doing like 6 month tours.
Uh-huh.
If you do four of them, that's 2 years. These people were living in the shit in the mountains, just attacking columns of people. And He Zexin was nicknamed the two-gunned girl general. And when Mao married her, Mao had not divorced his second wife, Yang Kaiwei, who was in November of 1930, was captured and beheaded by KMT generals, He Jian. So,
Jesus.
Yeah, man, he is trash. like you can say whatever you want to say about Mao. Some people like his philosophy. There's some good philosophy points. I have a social theory book right beside me with Mao quotes in it. There's some good social theory stuff. You might love communism and fuck with Mao, but you might say he's awful
as a person.
But as a boyfriend and a husband, yeah, this nigga's garbage.
Pretty trash. Yeah, just shopping around. Awful. Like, I'm, like, you know, you're not immediately with me. I'm gonna go shop around. I got the two-gunned girl general. All right. Yeah.
He just goes out and fucks an 18-year-old. It's 1930. He's 36 to 37 years old. I think he's 37 years old.
He's half his age.
Yeah. Trash, bruh.
Yeah.
Wait, I wish there was a bell for trash. Ding, 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 ding. Trash, bruh.
Or just like beep, beep, beep.
It's like a backing beep, up trash
to
can
to pick up the trash.
Yep. Yep. Okay. All right. Yeah, that was a pretty good one. Thank all right. You. So they evacuate the Jingang Shan Mountains, and it led to like a drop in morale. Many troops became disobedient. They began like thieving. This word, the Central Committee, the Central Committee, who was now underground in Shanghai, and they saw Mao's army as the lumpen proletariat. Is it lumpen proletariat?
I think it's lumpen.
So lumpen proletariat, we're going to say that. We're going to shoot that. That's lumpen. Obviously a very Karl Marx-y, yep, German-ass word.
Lumpen. Maybe it is lumpen. You got me lumping. Oh, okay.
No. We're not. No. I don't know what music you listened to in the 2000s.
In love.
Okay.
I can't help it. A girl can't help it. Oh, babe, I can't help it. A girl can't.
Okay. Do you want us not to have listeners to this podcast?
I'm finished.
like, Jesus Christ. Okay.
What does she say? Jumping? I guess she does jump it. You got me jumping. Maybe. Stumbling.
Is that Gwen?
I think.
Is that Gwen Stefani?
I don't know. That's just one of those little sound bites that's embedded in my skull for years.
You know, man. The radio was a wild thing when it existed.
Yep.
So the lumpen proletariat, the central community thought that Mao's forces were lumpen proletariat, which means that they were like, they were proletariat, but that were unable to like share in the class mm-hmm. consciousness of the proletariat. Mm-hmm. They thought they were like, they basically just thought they were fucking hicks who didn't really get it. basically, because they thought that the central community believed that the urban proletariat, the people in the cities, were the one who could lead to a successful revolution. But Mao thought that his peasants and peasants in general were the people who were the key, because he had seen, you go back to our last episode I think 1927 or 1928 Hunan uprising, he had seen it in practice. He had seen the uprisings in practice. He had seen the proletariat take the means of production in practice, and he was like, these are the people that are actually going to lead the revolution.
Lumpen proletariat is just like peasants and poor people who don't realize that this is all bullshit quite yet.
Yeah.
Once they realize it's all bullshit, then they're gonna band together and fucking seize your means of production and steal your shit. But it's like they have yet, the switch has not been flipped, you know?
The lumpen proletariat is that nigga at fucking Chick-fil-A that mm-hmm. fucking smiles and is happy to work at Chick-fil-A. You're the fucking lumpen proletariat.
You're a fucking tool,
dog. You're a tool. You're fucking tool. Realize they're not paying you shit.
Yep.
And you like realize it, dog.
Yeah.
Don't thank them to come in.
Mm-hmm. Don't develop Stockholm syndrome and be like, oh, they're good for me. They gave me a 50-cent raise last spring.
Yeah.
It's like, no, they're exploiting it. I was thinking, like, to the Chick-fil-A metaphor, lumpen proletariat, that's all of us consumers who have not banded together against Chick-fil-A to overthrow their exploitive policy of not giving us more than two sauces in our order, right?
No, you only get two sauces?
Man, they're bullshit. They're a franchise, and so every store has their different rules, but they're usually very stingy about, like, okay, which sauce do you want? And you name which sauce you want, and they give you, like, two. And
I usually,
what are you doing?
I usually just go up to the window and I just say, and don't skip on the sauce, bitch. And that's just to a dude. That's not to a woman. That's to a man. Yeah, I just want to make that clear.
Yeah.
I'm not toxic. All right. So the Central Committee, they were like, they wanted Mao to disband his army and for his units to be sent out to like spread the revolutionary message.
They just want him to recruit, basically.
Yeah, they just want you to be a fucking recruiter. Mm-hmm. Mao didn't disband, because he saw it differently, he's like, this is the way, this is a theme that's gonna continue through, the whole way, until the end of this, and in this time, one thing that's very apparent is that a lot of the Chinese communists, the original Chinese communists, they see China as the key to world, a world revolution to defeat imperialism and colonialism, and that's not how the Soviet Union sees it.
That's not how Russia said. We were the first world revolution. We're the one who kicked off this whole shit. Not fucking China, man. It's us.
And that's gonna go deeper down the line to a kind of a unification of the third world, and that's gonna be a thing that Mao talks about later. Okay. So Moscow comes in and they send kind of new communists that were trained in Russia and kind of have a Russian ideology to China to kind of take over the Central Committee, and they're known as the 28 Bolsheviks. And Mao disagreed with the new leadership, believing that they grasped little of the Chinese situation. And Mao and these 28 Bolsheviks, Mao would be a key rival of theirs.
Mao versus 28 dudes.
Yeah, Mao versus 28 dudes sound like a dope Kung Fu movie.
It sounds pretty good.
It does sound pretty good. I would actually love to see Mao fight.
We watched Chicago last night.
Chicago?
We watched the musical and stuff. Yeah, how they have like the whole stage production that's paralleling what they're going through in the actual story itself, if there was like a kung fu retelling of Mao's story, where all the showdowns are like Mao's army represented by Mao, who is this elite kung fu warrior fighting other kung fu warriors, it would be cool.
Look, man, I am not down. Because Mao's little front temple low when he goes bald is kind of wild. Huh. And I'm afraid I'm going to have that. So that's what I'm scared about.
Okay.
So in February 1930, Mao created the Southwest Jiangxi provincial Soviet government in the region under his control. And in December, he had to kind of beat down like a little coup that happened. And he did one of like his first purges where he tortured and executed as many as 2,000 to 3,000, 2,000 to 3,000 dissenters.
You're not a real communist until you purge, man.
You purge. You gotta fucking purge, bro. Yep. You gotta fucking purge. Yep. And we see that he's taking these experiences and he's saving them in the hard drive. You know what I mean? He's understanding. Yep. Oh no, people gonna come after me. So now I gotta torture.
I have to crush this with an iron fist.
So after the Japanese invasion of Manchuria, in 1931, Chiang Kai-shek, who was running the nationalist government, adopted the slogan of first internal pacification and then external resistance.
That's stupid.
Well, he was just like, all right, we got to unify. I got to get rid of the communists first, which is kind of dumb because the Japanese are fucking beating down
your fucking
throat.
It should be nationalism. We're all Chinese. Let's fucking kill these Japanese. Exactly. Not like, I'm going to kill the communists first and then this external threat. That's silly.
True. And then, however, this policy was brought to an end for a time when the Japanese lost an advance on Shanghai and bombarded Nanjing. And that was a little bit later. Here's the thing. Just some characteristics of the nationalist rule, so we don't set up like, who's good and who's bad. They're all kind of trash. I think the communists in the end kind of proved to be more trash just because they ended up ruling and doing some fucked up shit.
That might be because they won. I was going to say.
But the nationalist rule was fucked up too. Like, they killed thousands of communists and communist sympathizers. Around 2 million Hainan civilians were starved to death due to grain being confiscated and sold to other peasants for the profit of the nationalist government officials.
Nice.
4 million, mostly ethnic minorities, Chinese minorities, perishing at the start of both the Civil War and the Second Sino-Japanese War, starving to death and dying from disease and conscription campaigns, and 5,000 Chinese civilians perishing from malnutrition, famine, or caused from nationalist flooding to stop the Japanese advance. So they have their bodies. Let's be clear.
Yeah, there's plenty of skeletons.
So the next kind of step for the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, is that they moved to Jiangxi, which was a secure area for them. And in November of 1929, in November of 1931, Jiangxi was proclaimed to be the Soviet Republic of China.
And this is Mao's holdings?
This is Mao. So Mao is the CCP moves there.
Oh, okay. So Mao gets it first, and then the kinda CPC comes and is like, hey, we're going to set up shop here. You got a good thing going on.
This is a good thing.
It's ours now. And it's like, okay, cool.
So Mao is like the head of the state, kind of the head of the government. And at its peak, it was like over 30,000 square kilometers. This is their first try. Mao's first dry run at like communist government. 30,000 square kilometers, population over 3 million. But then Mao gets replaced by Wang Ming, a Chinese communist returning from the Soviet Union, one of the 28 Bolsheviks. And the Chinese Red Army will be commanded by a 3-man military committee, which included Wang Ming's associates, and one of them being Otto Braun, one of them also being Chou Enlai, and the other one was Bo Gu. So it was a state. Like they had a central mint. They printed paper bills. They had like money with linen on it with Chinese lettering. I think Mandarin or Cantonese. I think it was Cantonese because they were more in the southern part of China at this time. And this was one of a couple of red bases. Red bases are kind of all over. It's kind of like anywhere like a communist commander can get like a couple of villages together and be like, this is a red base. Another one being like the Hubei, Henan, and Shaanxi Soviet, more in, I think, the central region of China. So,
okay.
So, Mao, there's kind of a conspiracy theory. Obviously, Mao is angry about, like, getting kind of thrown to the side and kind of getting reduced in power. There's about how angry he was and what he did. There can be varying aspects and, you know, different reports about that. I think in June Chang's book, she kind of goes in the him like going off to like a fucking like mountain temple, a hill temple somewhere, and storing up a bunch of cash that made storing up a bunch of cash and loot.
Okay.
Just life in the Jiangxi Soviet Republic of China is very it sucks. Mm-hmm. It primarily sucks. Like it's there. Like you could there might be some positives, but there's also reports that there were like there's mass famine and shit. And you know what I mean? It's their dry run. Dry run.
Yeah, yeah.
So, kind of once you get to 1934, you know the Jiangxi Soviet Republic of China has been happening, and then Chiang Kai-shek comes and encircles the communists. And this is the beginning of the long march. They have to break out of here, and they have to get the fuck out of here. So, the communists break out of this encirclement, and how they do that is up for contention. Kind of CCP doctrine will tell you that the communists basically. They're like some Cantonese warlords that were like in favor of them. That were kind of like they kind of fucked with them because they did trade with these Southern Cantonese warlords, and there was like a relationship with them. So the TCP will tell you, oh, that's how they got out. Juk Chang has her conspiracy theory that I personally like, just because I'm a little bit of a conspiracy guy. Epstein didn't kill himself. You know what I mean? So, so Juk Chang kind of theorizes that the communists were let. Out of the encirclement by Chiang Kai-shek, because Chiang Kai-shek sent his son in 1925 to the Soviet Union to be educated, and then when the communists and the nationalist Kuomintang break happened, Chiang Kai-shek's son was kept in China and worked in what was basically, you know, a factory.
You mean kept in the Soviet Union?
Kept in the Soviet Union, excuse me. Kept in the Soviet Union and basically worked in a factory in the Ural Mountains. Ural Mountains, not a fun place.
Yeah, we're going to revoke that scholarship real quick and have you break up rocks.
Yeah. So Juk Chang out there kind of like basically gives us this conspiracy theory saying that Chiang Kai-shek allowed the fucking communists to break out just as like a sign to Russia saying, hey, I'm going to let them out of this situation. I'm not going to totally destroy them. Give me back your son. Kind of correspondence between
quid pro quo.
There's radio messaging and correspondence between the two, like where he's kind of like hinting, he's not saying it exactly. It's a whole thing. Also, Chiang Kai-shek particularly directs the kind of path Judy Chang theorizes directs the path of the communist breakout, particularly through two kind of places, through Guizhou and then through Sichuan. Guizhou and Sichuan being two places that had warlords that were not under the direct government, the direct control of the central government.
Okay.
So he's trying to do some Machiavellian bullshit where he fucking like gives these warlords an enemy and they need saving so he can come in and just be like, hey, I'm the guy.
Yeah. Who are these assholes? Let's team up to take these, just like pit your enemies against your enemies to where they exhaust each other's forces. So that way he can come in and clean the fuck up.
So the communists kind of break out and they're going along that Guizhou path and they're in Guizhou and then they come to there's the communist Zunyi conference in January 15th through the 17th in 1935, and that's where with kind of Chiang Wen-lai's specific like explicit backing Mao kind of wins over the meeting and gains a lot of power, not complete power over the Politburo or this kind of Soviet red base or group of army or whatever, but kind of gains more control and has more people in the places that he wants them in. So the they're getting pushed up through Sichuan, and I love Sichuan chicken. And is that wrong to say?
I don't think
so. Is
that
wrong to say right now? I just keep thinking about that. Every time I say chicken, Sichuan, yeah, I'm thinking about some nice little pepper flakes, little peppers. Uh-huh. So they're getting pushed up to Sichuan, but if you look at the map of the actual fucking Long March, it's fucking like there's a point where they go through Guizhou and they kind of just circle around. Mm-hmm. Right at the border of going into Sichuan. And one of the reasons that's theorized is that by Judy Chang, this is all kind of her kind of conspiracy theory backed up with a little bit of evidence, but kind of there's some detractors. People have written kind of like essays about it. I don't know about this. She's saying that he does not want to go up and meet it, go up through Sichuan because Mao is going to meet another red base general, another communist leader named Chiang Kuo-tao, and Chiang Kuo-tao has an army of 80,000. And at this time, Mao only has like 20,000 to 30,000 troops, and he knows if he meets that other army, he's gonna fucking lose power.
Yep.
So and this is what Judy Chang is saying, right? He's gonna fucking lose power. So he circles around for a little bit.
Okay.
And there's even like in Judy Chang's book, she's kind of saying there's even like testimony that like they would. If they went straight to Sichuan, there was no shelling. There was no planes flying overhead. But once they stepped off that path, there was like planes flying overhead. There was artillery all the time. There's even a unit that goes into Sichuan, and they fucking been getting shelled all the time. Fucking, and as soon as they pass into Sichuan, nobody fucks with them.
I wonder if there's some like shady deal going on of like you're not supposed to attack Sichuan between like the Japanese and like Chiang Kuo-tao.
It's Chiang Kai-shek saying, hey, go to Sichuan.
Go to
Sichuan.
The nationalists are the ones not bombing.
Yeah, the nationalists are the ones not bombing. They're saying
trying to encourage,
go to Sichuan so we can do this thing that we've all that we're trying to make happen. Yeah. And Mao decides, nah, fuck that.
I'm gonna do my own thing.
He's gonna do his own thing and then take this alternative path that goes all the way the fuck around, goes through like almost through Tibetan territory, fucking goes on like, and it's a ridiculous, insane path.
Two paths divergent in a frosted lane. Betwixt the two roads I was intertwined. I had to choose the one less traveled, and that has made my people very unhappy.
They've made them all dead. And you know what? That is almost as good as Mao's poetry.
Okay.
It's like that stuff. It's like, God damn, dude.
I thought I'd butcher some Robert Frost for us.
No. His philosophy, there's some, you know what? There's some valid things in there that's like pretty dope. But his poetry, come on, bro.
Yeah.
Come on, my nigga.
I guess he wouldn't write haikus. I'm sure maybe he wrote some. I don't know.
So, understanding, even with all the fuckery of the Long March and all like the weird things that happen, the Long March is one of the most incredible military feats of all time. They start out with 80,000 people, and they march 4,000 miles over what was like almost, I think, basically a year, or like a little less than a year, or a little more than a year.
Damn.
They march 4,000 miles. It crossed 24 rivers and 18 mountain ranges. They started out with 80,000 people, and by the time it was done, they had 8,000 people.
Damn, 90% just gone.
Yeah, so they meet up with Chiang Kuo-tao, and there's like some little dodgy shit that happens, and then Mao kind of emerges on the other side of the Long March as the kind of like undisputed leader of the Chinese communists, and when people learned about this, you know, kind of across the world, and it was publicized, people were like, "Yo, Mao is the man," And it's mostly just coming from his long march stories, you know. So Mao arrives in Yunnan, in the Yunnan Soviet, in October of 1935. And they start doing land distributions, offering medical treatment. They try to begin some literacy programs. Mm-hmm. And this is where like Edgar Snow comes in. You know what I mean? And you're gonna get his experiences and what he writes in Red Star Over China. And Red Star Over China is a book that kind of those experiences of the Long March and all the stuff that he hears from and all the stuff he's seeing in Yunnan. That's kind of spread around the world, and that's why like most like people at this time, they had a very, very positive opinion of Mao, especially if you were at anything to do with socialism.
Mm-hmm. Well, because he's like viewed as the underdog, or the way at least it's spun is that like here's this man who's gone through all these trials and tribulations, and he emerged from the other side victorious, and here is your role model, here is your figure.
So and then there's you know one guy that like helps him tremendously is Shao Li Zhu, which is Chiang Kai-shek's minister of propaganda. We'll get to kind of the unification of the KMT and the nationalists in the communists in a second. Shao Li Zhu, as a minister of propaganda, puts out so much positive shit about the communists, makes them look wholesome, kind of resurrects their image. As before, they were kind of hated. Like they were just this scrounging ass fucking group of people. They were roaming the countryside. They were taking shit from people. Yeah. They were like pressing people into the communist army. But now with Shao Li Zhu and Red Star Over China, even specifically within China, across the world is good, but specifically within China, the image of the Communist Party and particularly Mao is resurrected. Mm. And as far as like some of the incidents within the Long March, some of them might not happen the way they said they happened. There's particularly the incident or the heroics at Luding Bridge, where Chinese volunteers from the Red Army fucking stormed across the suspension bridge in the face of dramatic enemy fire, a regiment on the other side backed by warlord troops fucking firing at them, and they take it with the town on the other side with like I think heavy casualties, I think it's the way it's reported. Deng Xiaoping, the leader of China after Mao, says, hey, well, about Luding Bridge in particular, well, that's the way it was presented in our propaganda as heroic. We needed to express the fighting spirit of our forces. In fact, it was a very easy military operation. There really wasn't much to it. And the other side were just some troops of a warlord who were armed with old muskets. And it wasn't really much of a feat, but we had to dramatize it.
Hey, man, you can't trust the liberal media, you know, that are out to get you, that are out to spin things, and they're just not objective, and they'll do whatever they can in order to sell a headline, man.
It's interesting because like it's you see it throughout you know kind of history is like people present these military feats, and when you actually study the military feats, it's very different. You know what I mean? But you know, I mean, you know, it's, you know, I'm not going to blame the communists for something everybody does. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's not a tactic exclusive to the communists.
Yeah. So the moment that kind of brings China together for a little bit is in 1936 is the kidnapping of Chiang Kai-shek and the Jiangnex incident. Yeah, the president of a country just gets kidnapped in 1936.
Nice. No big deal. Don't worry about it.
He gets kidnapped by this guy named the Zhang Zhuleng, which is nicknamed the Young Marshal, who was kind of the ruler of Outer Mongolia or most of like northern China.
Yeah.
Who had kind of been kicked out by the Japanese.
Yeah.
He kidnaps Chiang Kai-shek in a feat in order to get Chiang Kai-shek to stop fighting the communists and to start fighting the Japanese and to lay off the communists.
So just do what's sensible for all of China, as if you would just fight the actual enemy instead of the internal enemy.
And Judy Chang kind of theorizes, And this is something that she says she has telegraphs on. And if you read the book, she's going to talk about it, which is just going to be that the young Marshall was just like, he was like, I can just kill him and I can just become the fucking, and this is the more sinister view of Mao, is that apparently like there was like that Mao had kind of prompted the young Marshall to do this. In order to get Chiang Kai-shek out of the way, because Mao hated the nationalists so much, which he did hate the nationalists. Let's not even fight that fact. So what comes out of this is that there's a second united front between the Chinese nationalists and the Communist Party, Chinese nationalists, which are the Kuomintang and the Communist Party, to kind of fight and resist the Japanese invasion during the second Sino-Japanese war. There's also
is this where the National Revolutionary Army or the NRA comes in?
So this is when like start having the NRA, they join. This is part of that whole Edgar Snow thing. Yeah. This is them coming together. This is when the propaganda minister starts promoting them as good people. Okay.
I was wondering about that, why like Chiang Kai-shek's minister of propaganda was helping out Mao. But now it makes sense.
I had to go to the Jian incident, and then I feel like I needed to come back towards that because I didn't want to leave all that looting stuff up there. There's also a theory that the reason why Chiang Kai-shek agreed to stop fighting the communists and go fight the Japanese is that his son, Chiang Ko, who was in Russia, would now be allowed to come back to China, which did happen after this.
Okay. All right. So maybe the Soviets were the ones prompting him the whole time to, like, hey, turn on the Japanese. We're worried about them, too.
Yeah. The Soviets are always worried. Always worried about Japanese because they fought a war with the Japanese. Yeah,
1905.
They fought and they lost that mug.
They know about those wily Japanese.
So this is also 1937 is kind of a renaissance for Mao. Yanan is kind of a renaissance for Mao. He's becoming more popular than ever. And also at the time, Chiang Kai-shek was also popular. In 1937, also, Zhe Xin, the two-gun girl general, who was wounded on the battlefield, 14 pieces of shrapnel, trying to follow Mao.
Jesus.
This was 2 months after she had a baby, on the Long March, and just left it in a village. To be raised by people that she didn't know because there had been too much to care for a baby on the long march.
Yeah,
some of the shrapnel couldn't be removed from her head, and she was in and out of comas as having to be carried by stretchers. But she was but Hei Shuixuan, the two gunned girl general,
I think
Mao's wife at the time. She went through all this with Mao. She fucking took the strap mail, had the baby. Fucking Mao's writing jokes about how easy it is for her to have babies. She's fucking still has strap mail lodged in her fucking head. And fucking she goes to Russia for treatment, sustained in battle. And what does Mao do? He meets another woman called Jian King. And starts to take up with her in 1937. Jian King was a famous actress from Shanghai.
All right.
Who
he's trash. Beep. Fuck that. That's what you do. You know, your girlfriend, your loyal, loving girlfriend gets shrapnel in the face, and then when she goes to the Soviet Union for medical treatment, you start dating an actress. Yeah. That's just the natural course of life. That's the natural progression of
life. That's how you do it. Mm-hmm. So GRK is it was a little bit of a scandal for him to like date Jian King, who becomes the infamous later. Her name is Madame Mao, known as Mimi Mao.
I don't want to say that this is the the Ava Braun of China, but
he kind of is. No, well, Ava Braun of is kind China. Of wrong. Like Ava Braun didn't do as much shit as Mimi Mao did.
Oh like, shit. Okay.
Like Mimi Mao is a little bit more nefarious.
But if Jian Qing is Ava Braun, that would make Mao
Hitler.
And well, okay, I don't know.
Yeah, we're gonna have that whole conversation.
I don't know.
We're gonna have that whole conversation later about how many deaths you cause and if you mean to do it or if you don't mean to do it and what that entails. We're gonna talk about that a little bit later. So Jian Qing, not to shame anybody, but was in the tabloids for her love life. She had been in numerous films. She like married actor director Tang Na in 1936. This is 1 year before she goes to Yeonan. Okay. Like, and however, he soon discovered that she was continuing her relationship with Yu Qiwei. The scandal became public knowledge, and he made two suicide attempts before their divorce was final. And then the next year, she goes to Yeonan. Like, I'm not shame anybody.
I mean.
But,
they sound perfect. Mao and Jian Qing sound perfect for each other. Like, they're both extremely toxic individuals.
Oh, they're both
ruin the lives
toxic.
Of their partners. You know, it's like let's make each other miserable. You know,
they're both toxic people. And okay. when you talk about Yeonan and Yeonan is the second. This is the second chance at this communist paradise.
Okay. Yeah,
and you know they put in programs and you know literacy programs, kind of redistribution programs and all that type of stuff. There are reports that Yeonan was like a hellscape terror place. where a lot of the practices that would happen in the Cultural Revolution of like the kind of terrorist. Mind terrorist like shit, terrorizing people's minds that happened in the Cultural Revolution were kind of first introduced and first practiced in Yeonan. They would have you write down all your fucking thoughts. They'd have everybody you spoke to, what the conversations were about. They have you write down everybody from your village, every interaction you had ever had with those people, who exactly they were, how exactly you were connected to them, when you had taken trips, places. So when somebody came from outside of Yeonan, outside of the Red Base, and they came, they're like, oh, I'm from Hunan. They'd be like, oh, where in Hunan? And you'd be like, this village. And they'd be like, okay, let's look you up in this book. Okay, you're not in this fucking book. You're a goddamn spy.
You're a liar. You're a spy.
There was torture. There was malicious shit going on. Yeonan had a lot of weird caves. There seemed to be a lot of, like I think that there
a lot
there
of weird cave activity.
Caves.
Going on.
There was people heard screaming. A lot of torturing going on. You would have to denounce people and put like it was. There was this group of people, especially young people, who had came after reading about the Red Star over China. Red Star Over China and seeing the propaganda that that the propaganda minister put out, I think Xiao Lizu or whatever, I can't remember his name a little bit earlier, reading what he had put out, all this reading all this stuff and seeing all this stuff, and they came and what they got was like an authoritarian hellscape of certain reports say an authoritarian hellscape. I want to make sure that you know what I mean? And kind of a kind of experiment in the kind of Confucius kind of combined communist authoritarian shit of right thinking.
Ah, right thinking.
That we talked about in the first episode.
Within kind of, the bubble, the moral compass.
Yes. Yeah. This is kind of the maturation of this shit. And it's like it's maturing. They're figuring out like. How
you would build an authoritarian hellscape.
Yeah. Okay. So you go from 1937, 1945. This part right here, they're fighting the war. There's a lot of interesting shit here about how the US is starting to get involved because the US has interest in fighting Japan in World War II. This is there's a lot of games between the Soviets, US, I'm gonna call this what this is. This was World War II. And Mao was a part of this.
There's
a clusterfuck. The nationalists are fighting the Japanese. Mao and the communists are fighting the Japanese. And sometimes they're not. Sometimes they are. And we're gonna fast forward to the end of World War II. where, you know, where towards the end, the U.S. had was continuing, you know, the military consistent military assistance to Chiang Kai-shek and his KMT government forces against the People's Liberation Army, which was led by Mao. I think they changed their name. Likewise, the Soviet Union was given quasi-covert support to Mao by their occupation of northeastern China. This is at the end of World War II. And this is and that allowed the PLA to get all of the weapons that were left from the Japanese Kwantung Army. So, like, all the Japanese weapons, they just got this massive supply of fucking weapons. And, like, the Japanese have surrendered. You know, Chiang has been... Chiang is in Chongqing. That's where his government's at. And they're ill-equipped to, like, reassert authority. American troops and weapons, both of the KMT forces, allow them to kind of reclaim the cities. But Mao doesn't give a fuck about the cities. He's all about that countryside. He's all about that countryside. He's about the peasants in the countryside. So the countryside's under communist control. Chiang had just antagonized too many people. His party was weak. It was weakened in the war against Japan. And meanwhile, the communists... They were emboldened. They were the propaganda before at work. Yeah. They were the Chinese nationalists. They seemed pious even. You know what I mean?
And they had all these fancy new Japanese weapons.
They got fancy new Japanese weapons. So, you know, following the war, the US was like encouraging peace talks between Chiang and the communists.
The communists are like, you don't negotiate when you're on top or in a position to be on top or
Yeah, I mean, I think by now they're starting to think, man, we could take it.
We don't need to come into the table quite yet.
It kind of due to concerns about like widespread and well documented the corruption of the Chiang government throughout its rule. As I said before, man, they were corrupt, like $1 million. I think they like some of like the ways that they fucking were corrupt. They would like inflate. They would make so much money that they would inflate the Chinese currency. like they were fucking corrupt.
Damn.
So the US government like just limited aid to Chiang like in the midst of fighting like the
back when we gave a shit.
Yeah, like just like they would. And this is interesting, I think Henry brought this up. This is kind of the first Cold War proxy war happens here.
Yeah, you have the U.S. supporting Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalists because they hate the communists, and then you've got the Soviet Union bolstering up Mao and the PLA, I guess, and like supplying them with those Japanese weapons, and you've got a split in the state of China between two different Chinese factions backed by the Soviet Union and the United States.
You know what I mean? So... this low morale and disorganization of the nationalists like allowed the communists to gain the upper hand in the Civil War. And then there's also like Chinese between the Chinese nationalists, there's competition and there's rivalries. Uh-huh. A new constitution was promulgated in 1947. Chiang Kai-shek was elected by the National Assembly as the first president of the Chinese Republic on 20th of May in 1948. The communists refused to recognize the new constitution, its government, and any of this shit as legitimate. Mm-hmm. And Chiang resigned on January 21st of 1949 because fucking the KMT was suffering these incredible losses and these terrible defeats, and you know all people were defecting to the communists all the time because they looked like the fucking good guys. Nice. And you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so after Chiang's resignation, the vice president of the ROC of the Republic of China, Li Zongren, who was a nationalist, became China's acting president. There was still a conflict between like Chiang and Li. It just persisted, and the inability of Li to like really coordinate the military forces led him to have an inability to put in fact like a good plan to defend like China.
So, from the communists. From he the couldn't communists, put down the civil war because Chiang just decided not to support him or not to cooperate.
Yeah, so Chiang just like refused to allow nationalist troops who were loyal to him to aid in the defense of like towns like Guangxi and Canton. And with the result, the communist forces occupied.
Making gains.
They were making gains. And then on October 4th, 1949, Mao proclaimed the foundation of the PRC in a single party state that controlled the CPC and like kind of proclaimed that they controlled China. And then in the early morning of the 10th of December of 1949, communist troops laid siege to Chengdu, the last of a KMT-controlled city in the mainland. And now, after that, after they took that town, China was officially all red. Hmm. It was all communist. And now the struggle part of Mao, the part that arguably, if you talk about the continued struggle, is the most admirable part about Mao in terms of the way he persisted.
Yeah.
We're going to get to the governing part on the next episode.
Yeah.
And this nigga fucks up a lot. He just fucks up a lot. And it's not funny to laugh about people's, like, maybe what is it, like 40? It's like if we go low ball estimates over his whole thing, it's at least 50 million people's death.
Okay.
That's low ball.
Damn.
That's low ball. Fuck. That's, like, you're playing the low ball, 40 to 50 low.
It's also interesting how you can be reactionary, or it's almost easier to criticize than it is to put a new system in place, you know, is you can be anti-government or like anti whatever regime is in power and be like, you're fucking up, you're doing all this bullshit, but without saying like, here's what I would do, without offering a substitution. And then you criticize so much that you get into power because everybody else is unhappy with the government that is in power. And then once you get in there, you realize what a struggle it is to get any work done in government.
Yeah.
Complete, or like what good policy actually looks like and what it means. And you might have ideas, but that doesn't mean that you're going to be able to implement them effectively. And it's just a whole nother beast when you go from criticizing government to governing.
Here's the thing. I'm all about what you're saying. I fuck with what you're saying right there. But then, like, also with Mao, it's just a lot, bro. He just went for it.
Yeah, he just tried to do it.
I think a lot of this, what we're going to talk about next episode, is like when you put in that hot regimen of fear.
Yep.
And people they're afraid to like give you accurate stuff. That can throw your shit off.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. When it's not, and this is going to, I think we're going to tie this in. When right thinking doesn't even allow you to do anything, like to have a correct assessment.
Yeah.
Because the correct assessment isn't right according to
the moral compass.
It's just not right.
Yeah.
It fucks up everything.
Yeah, well, it's all like lies are nice. Lies are fun to believe. Yeah. Lies make you feel good, but they're also lies. And eventually they come through and you're like, Jesus, how did we get here?
Lightweight over the rule 40 to 50 million.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, we're going to talk about it next week on Hard Fried History. Thank you for listening. Man, Henry, fucking, what's that social, big dog?
You can find me weird. At Henry E. Price on Instagram, Henry Price on Facebook.
You can find me at Joshua B. Stokes on Instagram and Twitter, Joshua Stokes on Facebook. You can find the podcast at Hard Fried History on Instagram, Hard Fried History on Facebook, and HFH Podcast on Twitter. Oh, man, we want to thank you guys for listening. Please, please share. Please subscribe. Please do whatever. We love you. Please come back next time. We'll talk to you next week. Love you. What's that song you were doing at the beginning? What's that song you're doing at the beginning?
You got me lumping. Oh, stumbling.
Never
heard
that.
Doop, doop.
Never heard that.
Guess you got me falling in love. In love.
Oh, I have heard that. Yeah, I have.
I can't help it. A girl can't help it.
Oh, babe.
All right, bye, guys.
A girl can't help
it. Oh, babe.
You know?